Hi, everybody. I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus, where we do another episode, I guess we could call it, of your questions and my answers. And I also want to thank you for the fact that that so many of you have elected to subscribe. It means so much to us, and we are very, very proud to say that we have crossed that magic line of 100,000 subscribers. I think we're up to like 102,000 now. So thank you, thank you, thank you. It means so much. And what it does is it pushes the YouTube algorithm to distribute us more widely. So it really is that important. Thanks again. So getting to the questions, the Answer X has a very timely question. John, I'm suspicious about Reza Pahlavi's role in the current Iranian opposition. Given his funding and media push, does he fit the profile of a CIA/Mossad asset being positioned for a soft coup? Do you think the agency is trying to hijack the genuine grassroots protests to install him as a pro-Western leader? He seems to be groomed exactly like past U.S. installed leaders to guarantee Israeli and U.S. interests in a post-IRGC Iran. Is this the standard regime change playbook? As a layman, I am 1,000% certain, 100% sure that Mossad CIA built him up during his time in exile in the USA. Am I right? First of all, that is one of the smartest questions that I've received in a long time. You are 100% right. So let's break it down. So Reza Pahlavi is the son of the Shah of Iran, who was thrown out of Iran in early 1979, February of 1979, came into exile briefly in the United States. That led to the Iran hostage crisis. Then we forced him out to the Bahamas and then to Panama and then to Egypt, and he died in Egypt. Reza Pahlavi is the son. He was a young guy when this happened. He was, a teenager. Well, now he's in his 60s. And he's never been to Iran since the 1970s. He's also something of a playboy in the Washington area. He's not a player in Iranian exile circles, but he seems to have a whole lot of money. Well, over the last couple of weeks, several things have happened. Number one, the Israeli government spilled the beans and they admitted that they have been financing him. So is he a Mossad asset? You bet he's a Mossad asset. Mossad is saying it. Number two, he doesn't know anything about contemporary Iran. Patrick Bet-David, the big podcaster, invited Reza Pahlavi to go on his podcast a week ago. And Reza never called him back, never even attempted to, you know, get his name out there, get his picture out there, talk about his view of a future Iran. He's not interested. Donald Trump has been pressured by people on the neoconservative right to welcome Reza Pahlavi into the Oval Office. He would be the person that the United States would announce is going to be, you know, the guy that we're interested in. And Trump said, no, he's not interested. I'm going to give you my own admittedly biased view. My own view is Reza Pahlavi is a joke. He's a caricature, a cartoon character. He lives in a mansion all by himself in Potomac, Maryland. Nobody pays any attention to him except these really rich Iranian exiles, most of whom are in Beverly Hills. The only people who really, really want him to be the leader of Iran are the Israelis. I'll add one other thing. As I said, the guy is a non-entity in Washington. He's a non-entity even in Iranian exile politics. But the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos and is the mouthpiece of the 1% of the 1%, ran an op-ed last week that Reza Pahlavi wrote. And he said that he wanted to go back to Iran to usher in a period of democracy. Like, what do you know about democracy? Your father was a fascist dictator who slaughtered his own people and who stole billions upon billions of dollars from the nation's treasury. So you think it should be you who goes back to Iran after 50 years and brings in a period of democracy? Come on, I'm insulted by that. So yeah, this guy's not going to be, I made a comment today kind of offhandedly, and the more I think about it, the more I believe it to be true. He wouldn't survive the walk from the plane to the terminal if he were to fly back to Iran. So he's not going to be the next leader of Iran. And yes, this is the CIA Mossad playbook for regime change. Yes, resist it. Jake Paul, 1006, says, hey, John, what are your thoughts on the ICE shooting in Minneapolis with the FBI taking over the investigation and not allowing the state to view evidence? I know you're a big fan of the FBI. Smile. Big fan. And thank you for helping me understand the world a little better every time you post a video. Thank you. Thank you, Jake. I have very strongly held feelings about what's happening in Minneapolis, and not everybody's going to agree with me. First of all, let's talk about the shooting. You're talking about this woman, mother of three young children, who was shot in the face and killed by an ICE officer last week. This was a violation of ICE's protocols. First of all, you cannot put yourself in front of a car to stop it, which is what he did. She was clearly trying to get away, to drive away. Secondly, you can't shoot into a moving vehicle. That is against ICE protocols, but he did it anyway. ICE officers do not wear body cams. This guy was shooting while holding his phone and filming. Why? And then ICE said, well, 10 years ago, he was a victim of violence, and so he's very sensitive to, well, if he was a victim of violence, number one, get him therapy. Number two, if the therapy doesn't work, he shouldn't be an ICE officer, just pulling out his gun and shooting unarmed women in the face. Number three, and this really puzzles me about supporters of ICE. These are mostly the same people who wanted to take Capitol police officers to the gallows for what happened on January, whatever it was, 6th. And these are the same people who are saying, we have to stand by law enforcement. ICE is law enforcement. You just wanted to hang law enforcement on January 6th. And now you're all about law enforcement. So people, pick a side for heaven's sake and stick with it. Regarding the FBI taking over this investigation, this is wrong, wrong, wrong. And I mean in capital letters. And I'll tell you why. Not just because John says so. But let's compare it to the Charlie Kirk assassination. Charlie Kirk's assassin was a kid from Utah. He left his house in Utah to go kill Charlie Kirk in Utah. And when he killed Charlie Kirk, he went back to his house in Utah, right? So the FBI says, look, this whole thing happened in Utah. The plot was hatched in Utah. The killing was carried out in Utah. This is a case for the state of Utah. If they need help from the FBI, the FBI stands to help. Okay, that's exactly the correct response. So here we are in Minneapolis. This woman is from Minnesota. She goes to an anti-ICE demonstration in Minnesota. An ICE officer shoots her in the face in Minnesota. She dies in Minnesota. The ICE officer gets in his car and runs away, remaining in Minnesota. So how in blazes is this a federal case? It's not. But then the FBI says, oh, we're taking it over. This is a federal case. Well, you know what? Kash Patel is not going to be the FBI director forever. And there's no statute of limitations on murder. So you can cover it up and you can hide this ICE guy all you want. But one of these days, somebody else is going to be in a position of authority at the FBI and in the White House, and they're going to prosecute this ICE guy for murder. Another thing, too, that bothers me very much. If you're a police officer or a federal law enforcement officer and you kill someone in the line of duty, there are very strict protocols for what happens next. You don't get in your car and run away, which is what this guy did. Why'd he run away? Because he knew he had done something wrong. So This bothers me very, very much. Thank you for that excellent question. Oscar Kruisfeld, 6556, says, "Hey, John, amazing story you have. I'm completely captivated. Thank you. For your next Q&A, do you think China having the role as the world's police would be better or worse for the world than the USA having it as currently?" That's a good question. And I'll preface my answer by saying that the Chinese would never want to be the world's policeman. It's just not a part of Chinese culture or Chinese foreign policy. We've said many times that the Chinese have such a longer term view than we have. We just take it upon ourselves to, you know, snatch the president of Venezuela or snatch the president of Panama or snatch the president of Haiti or send troops to Iraq or send troops to Afghanistan or troops to Somalia or troops to Libya or troops to Syria. And the Chinese are like, go ahead, knock yourselves out. The Chinese foreign policy is based on money. They have such a gigantic trade surplus. They're so awash in money that they're able to buy countries' loyalties. You know, we'll go to the Nigerians and say, hey, we're going to bomb northern Nigeria on Christmas. You're welcome. And the Chinese go to the Nigerians and say, hey, do you guys need an interstate highway system? We'll build that for you for free. We just want to have good relations. And so they have good relations. I'm not overstating it when I say that the Chinese essentially own Africa right now. They've completely muscled us out of Africa. Do you know that the Africa command of the US military is based in Germany? Do you know why? Because literally not one single African country wants to host us. That says a lot, a lot. So I think the Chinese wouldn't want the role as the world's policeman because they're actually winning the long-term game doing what they're doing now. I often ask rhetorically too, why can't we have a high-speed train system that can go from New York to Chicago in 5 hours or 4 hours? You know, how come our highways look like they're from Bosnia? How come we can't have the world's best hospitals or the world's most advanced airports or modern bridges that aren't crumbling and falling into the rivers below them? How come the Chinese have all that stuff and we don't? Because we spend $1 trillion a year on the military. That is more than the 8 biggest countries combined. Is it really worth it? I think that the Chinese think that eventually we're just simply not going to be able to pay the interest on our national debt and we're going to collapse. And that's when the Chinese move in. Stephen Harrison, 1837. John, love watching anything I see you in. You open insight. I think your open insight is absolutely enthralling. Thank you, sir. My question is, if you were advising on current foreign policy, who would you be monitoring as your biggest threat and why? The Chinese. The Chinese, not because they're outmaneuvering us financially. That's a separate but parallel issue. The Chinese, because they are so actively committing espionage against us. There are thousands upon thousands of Chinese PhD students across America in the hard sciences. Many of them are unactivated Chinese intelligence officers. And they're going to go into companies involved in big tech or pharma or bio, and they're going to steal secrets, whether they're commercial secrets or military secrets or tech secrets, and they're going to send it all back to China. The Chinese are very, very good at what they do, and they're very good at spying. I would also say, and I'm going to take heat for this, and I acknowledge that, but I think the Israelis are a major threat to us. The Israelis have hundreds of spies fanned out across the United States, almost exclusively in American defense contractors, to steal military secrets. Now, we give the Israelis 95% of our military secrets. That's fine. They want the F-35, take it. They want these advanced missiles. Here you go. But they're trying to steal that last 5%. That's not a friendly gesture. MIG Weld 5578 says, "Hi, John. Love your content from Australia. Thank you and hello to Australia. You know, I was just denied a visa last week to go to Australia because they said that they believed I was an intending immigrant and I wasn't going to leave. So there you go. My question to you is, what is your opinion on Aldrich Ames, who recently died in prison? You know, I just last night did a mini episode of my podcast, John Kiriakou's Dead Drop, about Aldrich Ames. Aldrich Ames is one of the most infamous traitors in modern American history. He was a drunk. His father was a drunk. And they were both CIA officers. Aldrich Ames was a failure as a CIA officer. He was never able to successfully recruit a single source because he was mostly drunk. And then when they finally sent him to Colombia to recruit spies to steal secrets, he ended up sleeping with one of the assets that had been turned over to him. And he cheated on his wife. He brought the asset back to the United States and he married her. Her name was Rosario Ames, as it turned out later. So his wife divorced him. He married Rosario. And Rosario had very expensive tastes. And so Ames quickly got into debt, $50,000 in debt. And so what he did is he just drove downtown to Washington, to the Soviet, at the time it was the Soviet embassy. And he said, "Hey, listen, I'm a CIA operations officer and I'll give you some operational information if you give me $50,000. They said, "Huh, glad to. Here's $50,000. So he compromised to anti-Soviet operations. He said later in an interview with the Senate Intelligence Committee that he thought he could pull off this one-time exchange. It was only after he took the money that he realized he was already in over his head. And so he started providing the Soviets with information on specific people who had been recruited by the United States, Soviet officials who had been recruited by the United States. Right off the bat, the Soviets executed two of them. And then Ames said, "Well, now I've gotten these two people killed, so the CIA is probably going to start an investigation. And one of the remaining sources for the CIA inside the Soviet Union is probably going to rat me out." So he ratted out all of the remaining CIA sources in the Soviet Union. Another 10 people were executed. Two were able to escape. The CIA dropped the ball in the investigation of Ames. The investigation was given to a 27-year-old counterintelligence center investigator. He let the file sit on his desk for 18 months. And then one day after 18 months, he drove over to Aldrich Ames's house in Arlington, Virginia, practically walking distance to the CIA. And he said, "Wow, nice house, $2 million at least." Oh, well, that was the end of it. He never bothered to ask, how does a guy making $70,000 a year afford a $2 million house, drive a Jaguar, and then brag to his colleagues that he just put an in-the-ground pool and built a gazebo? So a woman named Sandy Grimes picked up the case. Sandy said, "This is ridiculous. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the FBI to subpoena Rick Ames' banking records." And what she was able to put together was Ames would fly to Mexico City on vacation. And then within 5 days of returning from Mexico City, would put a huge deposit in the bank, totaling about $2 million. And so the FBI arrested him and he was charged with espionage. He was facing the death penalty because his actions had resulted in the deaths of so many people. But Rosario was also arrested. And the deal that was made with the Justice Department was, if you take the death penalty off the table and you let my wife do only 5 years and let her keep my pension, then I'll confess and I'll plead guilty. They did that. Rosario did 4 years in prison and then returned to Colombia, where the son that she shared with Ames was living with her mother. Ames got life without parole. He didn't fully uphold his end of the deal because his brain was so mushy from decades of alcoholism. He simply couldn't remember all the information that he had given the Soviets. He just couldn't remember. And so he ended up dying last week in the maximum security penitentiary hospital in Cumberland, Maryland. And the world is a better place without him in it. Okay. Czar SZZ says, "Hi, John. I've been a fan of your content for a few months now, especially that Joe Rogan Experience episode. Pure perfection. Thank you. I have a question that's been on my mind for a while now. Have you ever felt PTSD from your experiences in foreign countries, or even from the paranoia of being in a battle with the CIA? I'm really hoping for your insight on this and praying for that presidential pardon. Take care." Thank you. Thank you for your good thoughts. I'll tell you something I've never said publicly before. In 2017, a friend of mine who just happens to be a psychiatrist and a brigadier general in the army, and who could not treat me because we're friends, we're personal friends, referred me to a psychiatrist in Bethesda, Maryland, whose practice is solely for fucked up former CIA people. So I went to see her and I did a series of tests, and she said something that stuck with me. She said, "I find it fascinating that you have no PTSD from your time in Pakistan. You have no PTSD from your prison experience, but you have crippling PTSD from your divorce." Somehow, I was able to compartmentalize these different things in my life. My mom asked me one time when I got back from Pakistan, "Weren't you scared?" And I said, "No." Like, actually, not a single time was I ever scared. And she said, "How could that be possible?" And I said, "You know, on the one hand, I was so busy that I didn't have time to be scared. On the other hand, too, somehow I falsely convinced myself that bad things only happen to other people. So I wasn't going to get shot. I wasn't going to get blown up," which is stupid to even think that way. "And third, I think that the CIA trained me to have these very different facets of my life, and never the two shall meet. In the end, I was diagnosed with what they called major depressive disorder and anxiety, like crippling anxiety. But that was from my divorce. From my CIA time, nothing. When I got back from Greece, I had PTSD for a little while. And I went to visit a buddy of mine in New York. And I stayed over at his place. And when I woke up the next morning, he said to me, "Hey, you were shouting in your sleep." And I said, "Oh my God, are you kidding me? What did I say?" Because if you're a CIA officer and you talk in your sleep, you have to report yourself to security. You can't be a CIA officer who talks in his sleep, because there's a risk that you'll say something classified. So I said, "Oh my God, what did I say?" And he said that I shouted, "Bill, where's my gun? Bill, where's my gun?" Well, Bill is a guy I used to work with. And I always had a fear that I would be walking into an assassination attempt and either not have my gun on me or be fumbling for the gun. And I guess I must have been dreaming about it. So there you have it. All that for $80,000 a year. Scoop GB. Thank you for the £5, Scoop. He says, "Hi, John. Do you think the CIA are currently operating in Greenland?" Ah, that's a good question. Nobody's asked me that. "The U.S. administration has hinted that a referendum should be held amongst citizens of Greenland questioning becoming a part of the U.S. Do you think influence campaigns are already underway? Some military analysts say it would be impossible for the U.S. to take Greenland by force, assuming the rest of NATO stand up, as U.S. forces are neither adequately equipped nor experienced at fighting long-term in Arctic conditions. If they can't take it by force, what is the likely strategy?" Fantastic question. First of all, yes, I hate to say, I do think the CIA currently are operating in Greenland, not in any kind of numbers. They probably have two or three people there. They're probably on the U.S. Air Force base that's based in Greenland, and they're probably just trying to get the lay of the land and try to get an idea of what public opinion is like. I can tell you what public opinion is like because there have been polls from among the 50,000 people who live in Greenland. And the polls show like 95-5, they want to remain a part of Denmark. What is the most important issue? I find this fascinating. What is the most important issue to Greenlanders? Why do they so want to remain a part of Denmark? Because of the health care. Nobody wants American health care. Half of us go bankrupt because of the health care system here. And in Greenland, it's free. Everything is free. And Denmark's a peaceful country. Why rock the boat? Yesterday, I happened to be in LAX, Los Angeles Airport, and I'm sitting next to a guy who I don't know. And he just randomly turns to me and he says, "How crazy is this shit with Greenland?" And I said, "Yeah, it's crazy, right? Like, I can't believe we're even having this conversation." And he says, "Look what I just found." And he shows me on his phone. I took a picture of his phone. He's looking at a timeline of U.S. relations with Greenland. And he showed me something that I had never known before. On the timeline, it says 1917 to buy the Virgin Islands from Denmark. And I didn't even know we bought the Virgin Islands from Denmark. It says to buy the Virgin Islands from Denmark, the U.S. agrees not to make any claims against Greenland. And there's a picture of President Woodrow Wilson signing the treaty with Denmark saying we'll never try to take Greenland. I mean, what are we supposed to make of that? So I did some research. It turns out to be true. I didn't know it. I think most Americans don't know it. I also think that we really, really need to think about the effect on NATO. Now, Denmark, of course, is a NATO country. It was one of the original signatories of NATO, just like we are. Literally every country in the European Union last week, plus the UK, so that includes all of NATO, signed a statement, a joint statement, saying, "We're with Denmark on this. America, stay out of Greenland." President Trump said, "Oh, we probably won't invade Greenland. We'll buy it. And if they won't sell it to us, then we'll invade it." That will be the end of NATO. The end. And with the collapse of NATO, really, it only serves Russia. It serves China. It serves any of America's other enemies around the world. And for what? For Greenland? We already have a base there. At the end of the day, I think this is about the rare earth metals because Greenland is just stuffed with rare earth metals. I think that's what this is about. And Kyle, Stararium and Aquarium, 2394, says, "Hi, John, question for you. What are percentages of CIA operations that public knows about versus the ones that will never see the light of day? Does the agency stop 9/11-like attacks regularly?" That's a terrific question. I'm going to say fewer than 1% of CIA operations ever see the light of day. Fewer than 1%. I mean, some operations may be to, you know, drop a message inside a hollowed-out rock in front of a library in Havana. I'm just making that up. That's an operation. That's a legit operation. I once did an operation that cost me $5. And I remember my station chief saying, I need more people like you. You do a whole operation, cost $5. So there are, you know, thousands and thousands of operations that are taking place every single year. Almost none of them will ever see the light of day. Does the agency stop 9/11 like attacks regularly? I'm stumbling over the word regularly. Not regularly, but occasionally, yes. More often than not, the CIA ends up having to turn the information over to the FBI, and it's the FBI that actually does, you know, the arrests. The CIA, when it disrupts attacks overseas, it disrupts them, frankly, by killing the people who are going to carry out the attacks. It's not a very nice thing, but that's what the CIA's Special Activities Division does. There are also groups called Global Resources. That's what they do. In 2009, the New Yorker magazine broke a major story that almost nobody paid attention to. And that was something called the Tuesday Morning Kill List. So it turned out that John Brennan, when he became Barack Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor for counterterrorism, started something called the Tuesday Morning Kill List meeting. So every Tuesday morning at 7 a.m., Brennan would meet with attorneys from the National Security Council, attorneys from the CIA, and counterterrorism officials from the CIA. They would come up with a list of people around the world to kill that week. The CIA teams would fan out around the world. They would kill their targets, and then they would all come back and meet again the next Tuesday and get their kill list for that week. I have no idea if those meetings continue to take place, but that's primarily the way that the CIA disrupts future terrorist attacks, by just killing the people implicated in them before they can actually get started. And I'll add one other thing. I remember just being fascinated when I was still in the CIA with a group of Al-Qaeda fighters whom we saw training at a camp in eastern Syria. So we're watching these guys train. We're sending drones and we're watching with satellite photos, and they're doing like physical training, push-ups and climbing over walls and learning how to throw grenades. And then we see them in pictures, you know, doing shooting training and all kinds of stuff. And I asked my boss, why don't we just like send in a team and take these guys out? They're training to kill us. And he said to me, be patient, young man. What we ended up doing was we waited until they completed their training, and they all literally got onto a bus to drive to Iraq to carry out terrorist attacks on U.S. forces. And we droned the bus. We sent two missiles in. We vaporized everybody on that bus. That's how you prevent the next 9/11. It's not pretty, but that's real life. Okay, well, before I leave, I want to thank our sponsor again. I'm so proud that we have a sponsor. And I have a message from the sponsor. So here's something worth thinking about. Now that Donald Trump is back in office, there's growing speculation that gold could play a key role in Trump's economic agenda. 3 more years left in this term. It's not confirmed, of course, but some analysts believe that a gold reset could help tackle the national debt. There's a new report called Trump's $24,000 panic button that breaks this scenario down. It shows how a move like this happened before in 1934 under Franklin Roosevelt and why the conditions today look surprisingly similar. One surprising detail that most people don't know about is that the U.S. government still values gold officially at $42 an ounce. But gold today is trading above $4,400 an ounce. That gap could be used to revalue assets and rebalance the federal books. which means there's a chance that gold could skyrocket even more. If you want to understand what might be coming and how to protect your savings if it does, get the free guide. Go to johnlovesgold.com. Seriously, johnlovesgold.com. Or call 888-465-3053 to claim your copy. That's johnlovesgold.com or 888-465-3053. Thanks again for being with us. Thanks for all your excellent, well-thought-out questions. And thanks for putting us over 100,000 subscribers. We'll see you next time.